All right, we are really going to continue this evening along the same lines that we were speaking on last Wednesday night. We talked about the fugitive slave law and some of the incidents that occurred under the fugitive slave law that galvanized both the North and the South into their respective positions. And tonight I want to cover, in addition to some other things, I want to cover some material that will indicate how widespread racism was in the United States, not only in the South, but also in the North, as the country moved into the Civil War. And I'll begin by reading again from Battle Cry of Freedom by James McPherson. McPherson states that after the rescue of one of the fugitive slaves, furor over the fugitive slave law began to decline. This would be in the early 1850s. Perhaps this happened because the legions of law and order finally prevailed, or perhaps nearly all the eligible fugitives had decamped to Canada. In any event, fewer than one-third as many blacks were returned from the North to slavery in 1852 as in the first year of the law's operation. Democrats, conservative Whigs, mercantile associations, and other forces of moderation organized public meetings throughout the North to affirm support of the compromise, including the fugitive slave law. These same forces, aided by the Negrophobia, which simply means fear of the Negro, which was rampant in the North and in the South, that characterized much of the Northern population, went further than this. In 1851, Indiana and Iowa, and in 1853, Illinois enacted legislation barring the immigration of any black person, free or slave. Three-fifths of the nation's border between free and slave states ran along the southern boundaries of these states. Intended in part to reassure the South by denying sanctuary to fugitive slaves, the exclusion laws of these three states also reflected the racist sentiments of many whites, especially butternuts. The butternuts were northern supporters of the South. Although Ohio had repealed its Negro exclusion law in 1849, many residents of the southern tier of Ohio counties wanted no part of black people and were more likely to aid the slave catcher than the fugitive. Nevertheless, resentment of the fugitive slave law continued to simmer among many Yankees. Even the heart of an occasional law and order man could be melted by the vision of a runaway manacled for return to bondage. Among evangelical Protestants who had been swept into the anti-slavery movement by the Second Great Awakening, such a vision generated outrage and activism. This was what gave Uncle Tom's Cabin such astounding success. As the daughter, sister, and wife of Congregational clergyman Harriet Beecher Stowe had breathed the doctrinal air of sin, guilt, atonement, and salvation since childhood, she could clothe these themes in prose that throbbed with pathos as well as bathos. After running serially in an anti-slavery newspaper for 9 months, Uncle Tom's Cabin came out as a book in the spring of 1852. Within a year, it sold 300,000 copies in the United States alone. Now, that was a huge number of copies considering the population at that time. He says this was comparable to at least 3 million today. That was within a year. 1852. The novel enjoyed equal popularity in Britain and was translated into several foreign languages. Within a decade, it had sold more than 2 million copies in the United States, making it the bestseller of all time in proportion to population. Although Stowe said that God inspired the book, the fugitive slave law served as his mundane instrument. Quote, "Hattie, if I could use a pen as you can, I would write something that will make this whole nation feel what an accursed thing slavery is, said her sister-in-law after Congress passed the law. I will if I live, vowed Harriet, and she did, writing by candlelight in the kitchen after putting her six children to bed and finishing the household chores. Unforgettable chapters came alive in these pages, despite a contrived plot and episodic structure that threatened to run away with the author. Quote, that triumphant work, wrote Henry James, who had been moved by it in his youth, was much less a book than a state of vision. End of quote. Drawing on her observance of bondage in Kentucky and her experiences with runaway slaves during a residence of 18 years in Cincinnati, this New England woman made the image of Eliza running across the Ohio River on ice floes, or Tom enduring the beatings of Simon Legree in Louisiana, more real than life for millions of readers. Nor was the book simply an indictment of the South. Some of its more winsome characters were Southerners, and its most loathsome villain, Simon Legree, was a transplanted Yankee. Mrs. Stowe, or perhaps God, rebuked the whole nation for the sin of slavery. She aimed the novel at the evangelical conscience of the North, and she hit her mark. It is not possible to measure precisely the political influence of Uncle Tom's Cabin. One can quantify its sales, but cannot point to votes that it changed or laws that it inspired. Yet few contemporaries doubted its power. Never was there such a literary coup de main as this, said Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. In England, Lord Palmerston, who as Prime Minister a decade later would face a decision whether to intervene on behalf of the South in the Civil War, read Uncle Tom's Cabin three times, and admired it not so much for the story as, quote, for the statesmanship of it. As Abraham Lincoln was grappling with the problem of slavery in the summer of 1862, he borrowed from the Library of Congress a key to Uncle Tom's Cabin, a subsequent volume by Stowe containing documentation on which she had based the novel. When Lincoln met the author later that year, he reportedly greeted her with the words, so you are the little woman who wrote the book that made this great war. Uncle Tom's Cabin struck a raw nerve in the South. Despite efforts to ban it, copies sold so fast in Charleston and elsewhere that booksellers could not keep up with the demand. The vehemence of Southern denunciations of Mrs. Stowe's, quote, falsehoods and distortions was perhaps the best gauge of how close they hit home. Quote, there never before was anything so detestable or so monstrous among women as this, declared the New Orleans Crescent. The editor of the Southern Literary Messenger instructed his book reviewer, I would have the review as hot as hellfire, blasting and searing the reputation of the vile wretch in petticoats who could write such a volume. Within 2 years, pro-slavery writers had answered Uncle Tom's Cabin with at least 15 novels whose thesis that slaves were better off than free workers in the North was capitalized by the title of one of them. Uncle Robin in his cabin in Virginia, and Uncle Tom without one in Boston. A decade later, during the Civil War, a South Carolina diarist with doubts of her own about slavery reflected the obsession of Southerners with Uncle Tom's Cabin by using it as a constant benchmark to measure the realities of life in the South. In a later age, Uncle Tom became an epithet for a black person who behaved with fawning servility toward white oppressors. This was partly a product of the ubiquitous Tom shows that paraded across the stage for generations and transmuted the novel into comic or grotesque melodrama. But an obsequious Tom was not the Uncle Tom of Stowe's pages. That Tom was one of the few true Christians in a novel intended to stir the emotions of a Christian public. Now, you understand this is being written by McPherson, who, as far as I know, is not a Christian. But this is his view of it. Indeed, Tom was a Christ figure. Like Jesus, he suffered agony inflicted by evil secular power. Like Jesus, he died for the sins of humankind in order to save the oppressors as well as his own people. Stowe's readers lived in an age that understood this message better than ours. They were part of a generation that experienced not embarrassment but inspiration when they sang the words penned a decade later by another Yankee woman after she watched soldiers march off to war. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free. So I infer what I said about McPherson from the fact that he perhaps experienced his embarrassment in singing that. I don't know. I have some more material that will deal rather explicitly with the racism in the North as well as the South. But before I get to it, I want to cover an issue that we often encounter, and that is the issue of whether the Civil War was fought to abolish slavery. And Southerners traditionally have maintained that it was not, that that was not the purpose of the war. And most Northerners have maintained that it was the purpose of the war. And I thought I would read to you McPherson's little short essay on this from his book. Although the Southerners later bridled at the official Northern name for the conflict, the War of the Rebellion, many of them proudly wore the label of rebel during the war itself. A New Orleans poet wrote these words a month after Fort Sumter was fired on. Yes, call them rebels, 'tis the name their patriot fathers bore, and by such deeds they'll hallow it as they have done before. Jefferson Davis said repeatedly that the South was fighting for the same sacred right of self-government that the Revolutionary Fathers had fought for. In his first message to Congress after the fall of Sumter, Davis proclaimed that the Confederacy would, quote, seek no conquest, no aggrandizement, no concession of any kind from the states with which we were lately confederated. All we ask is to be let alone. Both sides believed they were fighting to preserve the heritage of Republican liberty. But Davis's last phrase, all we ask is to be let alone, specified the most immediate, tangible Confederate war aim, defense against invasion. Regarding Union soldiers as vandals bent on plundering the South and liberating the slaves, many Southerners literally believed they were fighting to defend home, health, wives, and sisters. Our men must prevail in combat or lose their property, country, freedom, everything, wrote a Southern diarist. On the other hand, the enemy, in yielding the contest, may retire into their own country and possess everything they enjoyed before the war began. A young English immigrant to Arkansas enlisted in the army after he was swept off his feet by a recruitment meeting. He later wrote that his Southern friends said they would welcome a bloody grave rather than survive to see the proud foe violating their altars and their hearths. Southern women brought irresistible pressure on men to enlist. If every man did not hasten to battle, they vowed they would themselves rush out and meet the Yankee vandals. In a land where women are worshipped by men, such language made them war mad. A Virginian was avid, quote, to be in the front rank of the first brigade that marches against the invading foe who now pollute the sacred soil of my beloved native state with their unholy tread, end of quote. A Confederate soldier captured early in the war put it more simply. His tattered homespun uniform and even more homespun speech made it clear that he was not a member of the planter class. His captors asked why he, a non-slaveholder, was fighting to uphold slavery. He replied, I'm fighting because you're down here. For this soldier, as for many other Southerners, the war was not about slavery. But without slavery, there would have been no black Republicans to threaten the South's way of life, no special Southern civilization to defend against Yankee invasion. This paradox plagued Southern efforts to define their war aims. In particular, slavery handicapped Confederate foreign policy. The first Southern commissioners to Britain reported in May 1861 that, quote, "the public mind here is entirely opposed to slavery." The sincerity and universality of this feeling embarrassed the government in dealing with the question of our recognition. In other explanations of war aims, therefore, Confederates rarely mention slavery except obliquely in reference to Northern violations of Southern rights. Rather, they portrayed the South as fighting for liberty and self-government, blithely unmindful of Samuel Johnson's piquant question about an earlier generation of American rebels, quote, "How is it that we hear the loudest yelps for liberty among the drivers of Negroes?" End of quote. For reasons of their own, most Northerners initially agreed that the war had nothing to do with slavery. In his message to the special session of Congress on July 4, 1861, Lincoln reaffirmed that he had no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with slavery in the states where it exists. The Constitution protected slavery in those states. The Lincoln administration fought the war on the theory that secession was unconstitutional and therefore the Southern states still lived under the Constitution. Congress concurred. On July 22 and 25, the House and Senate passed similar resolutions, sponsored by John J. Crittenden of Kentucky and Andrew Johnson of Tennessee, affirming that the United States fought with no intention of overthrowing or interfering with the rights or established institutions of the seceded states, but only to defend and maintain the supremacy of the Constitution and to preserve the Union with all the dignity, equality, and rights of the several states unimpaired. Republicans would soon change their minds about this, but in July 1861, even radicals who hoped that the war would destroy slavery voted for the Crittenden-Johnson resolutions, though three radicals voted no and 24 abstained. Most abolitionists at first also refrained from open criticism of the government's neutral course toward slavery, assuming that the death grapple with the Southern slave oligarchy must eventually destroy slavery itself. William Lloyd Garrison advised fellow abolitionists in April 1861 to, quote, "stand still and see the salvation of God," rather than attempt to add anything to the general commotion. A concern for Northern unity underlay this decision to keep a low profile on the slavery issue. Lincoln had won less than half the popular vote in the Union states, including the border states, in 1860. Some of those who had voted for him, as well as all who had voted for his opponents, would have refused to countenance an anti-slavery war in 1861. By the same token, an explicit avowal that the defense of slavery was a primary Confederate war aim might have proven more divisive than unifying in the South. Both sides, therefore, shoved slavery under the rug as they concentrated their energies on mobilizing eager citizen soldiers and devising strategies to use them. So, you see that it is a very arguable position that the war was not fought over slavery, but, in my humble opinion, it most definitely was fought over slavery in the sense that McPherson said, if it had not been for slavery, there would have been no war. And as you see all the things leading up to the war, slavery was the great, huge, overwhelming factor, issue that was in everybody's mind. I want to read a section from Alan Guelzo's book, The Crisis of the American Republic, A History of the Civil War and Reconstruction Era. Now, this history book is written by a Reformed Christian who is a very astute scholar. He's also, as you read this book, it's very evident, he's much more prejudiced, if you want to use that term, in favor of the North than James McPherson, whose book we've been reading for. McPherson gives a more balanced north-south viewpoint, even though it's clear, of course, as everybody, they're opposed to slavery. Guelzo, in this section, is talking about the service of African Americans in the military, in the Union Army. How this came about, and the obstacles that existed against it. And the section is entitled, By Their Own Strong Arms. After more than a century, nothing blurs the image of the Civil War more than the realization that white Northerners were less than enthusiastic about the Emancipation Proclamation. You see what he's saying? As we look back on the Civil War, as Americans look back on it today, we tend to see it as a bright dividing marker between slavery and anti-slavery, between North and South, clear-cut issues. But Guelzo is saying the issues were not clear-cut. After more than a century, nothing blurs the image of the Civil War more than the realization that white Northerners were less than enthusiastic about the Emancipation Proclamation, even though emancipation helped fend off the possibility of outside intervention in the war and provided nearly 200,000 extra soldiers and sailors to help win it. Even among Northerners who genuinely believed that slavery was an evil, emancipation was celebrated largely for the way it secured the triumph of free capitalist labor in the Republic, and few whites saw any connection between emancipation and extending Republican equality to blacks. It was clear that many Northerners, Lincoln included, believed that the next step after emancipation was the colonization of African Americans to Central America or the American Southwest, or repatriation to Africa. Quote, the African race here is a foreign and feeble element, explained Lincoln's Secretary of State, William Henry Stuart, a view echoed by the Secretary of the Treasury, Salmon Chase, who reluctantly agreed that, quote, the separation of the races, end of quote, was unavoidable, and that African Americans should seek happier homes in other lands. Even while he was discussing emancipation with his cabinet in the summer of 1862, Lincoln was advising a delegation of black leaders that it is better for us both to be separated. Even though your race are suffering, in my judgment, the greatest wrong inflicted on any people, it was still a fact, regrettable perhaps, but a fact all the same, that, quote, even when you cease to be slaves, you are yet far removed from being on an equality with the white race. There is an unwillingness on the part of our people, harsh as it may be, for you free colored people to remain with us, end of quote. Now, keep in mind that what we are seeing with the whole result of Africans being imported into the Americas for purposes of slavery is a gradual increase in racism. And we're now at 1860, the Civil War, and the racism, the attitudes of racism are rampant in both North and South, but they're only going to increase. They will increase after the war, and they will increase, especially in the South, after the war, and especially after Reconstruction in the South. And we're going to talk about Reconstruction a little bit. There are so many, many, many things that we are not able to even touch on. And if you find this this subject interesting, as I do, I would encourage you to get hold of some good books and read more broadly than the issues that we are touching on. Anyway, that was Abraham Lincoln's statement to a delegation of black leaders from Indiana. This was decidedly not a view shared by African Americans. But if numbers and influence meant anything, there did not seem to be much they could do about it. Out of a total population in the United States of 31,433,000 in 1860, African Americans numbered only about 4,441,000, some 14% of the population, and of that number, less than 500,000 were free. And even for those who were free, only a small number enjoyed anything like full participation in the political life of their communities or the Republic as a whole. Still, from the very beginning, African Americans never saw the war as anything but a war against slavery, and never saw the war against slavery as anything less than a struggle for full equality in the life of the American Republic. Hardly had Fort Sumter fallen than Frederick Douglass began agitating for a no-holds-barred assault on slavery as the central thrust of the war. Quote, "The slaveholders themselves have saved our cause from ruin." Douglass exulted in the summer of 1861, and he exhorted the readers of Douglass's Monthly to press, quote, "the keen knife of liberty to Southern throats." For Douglass and other Northern blacks, the most obvious way to nudge the war for reunion toward a war for abolition was to put black soldiers on the Union firing lines. And in 1861, thousands of Northern blacks stepped forward to volunteer. But there was a higher purpose to be served by black volunteers than merely the satisfaction of focusing white attention on a war about black slavery. By volunteering for military service alongside whites, African Americans were laying claim to a tacit equality with whites, to a common cause that whites and blacks shared equally, since it only stood to reason that if blacks could fight and die alongside whites, they were certainly fit to vote and work alongside them too. And perhaps because the logic of that position was as clear as it was, black volunteers in 1861 were abruptly shown the door by the War Department. There were, in the first place, a series of legal roadblocks to black enlistment, beginning with the Militia Act Lincoln used to call out the first volunteers, which limited volunteer service to white males. Oddly, Guelzo says, the U.S. Navy drew no such color line. But far more menacing were the attitudes of white Northerners who angrily fended off black volunteers with the warning. And here I have a problem. Do I say out loud the N-word? Perhaps I ought to, because otherwise you don't get the truth of what is the quotation. "We want you damned niggers to keep out of this. This is a white man's war." End of quote. Northern whites could read the political logic of black enlistment as easily as any black volunteer, and they wanted no part of it. Quote, "The Negro is not equal to a white man," insisted Arthur Carpenter, a white Union volunteer, and he was fearful that being called a United States soldier would put the African American upon an equality with us in being allowed to fight with us. Felix Brannigan, a white New York sergeant, wrote in an open letter to a New York City newspaper that "we don't want to fight side by side with the nigger. We think we are too superior a race for that." Many Northern blacks recoiled in disappointment and disgust from these rebuffs, but as Lincoln himself explained, any move to recruit black soldiers in 1861 would have turned white Unionists in the border states against him, a loss that all the black soldiers in the North could not have made up for. Quote, "To arm the Negroes would turn 50,000 bayonets from the loyal border states against us that were for us," Lincoln told an Indiana delegation that wanted to offer him 2 regiments of black volunteers in 1862. "It is the determination of the government not to arm Negroes unless some new and more pressing emergency arises." But by the fall of 1862, with Lee and Bragg rampaging into Kentucky and Maryland, that new and pressing emergency seemed to be upon Lincoln. And taking his cue from that emergency, Frederick Douglass, Remember, Frederick Douglass is the escaped black slave who becomes quite a literary man. Frederick Douglass swerved around to a new line of argument. Blacks should be recruited for war service, not because their enlistment would turn the war toward abolition and equality, but because in practical terms, black soldiers were a military necessity just to prevent defeat. Quote, "Our presidents, governors, generals, and secretaries are calling with almost frantic vehemence for men," Douglass observed. "And yet these very officers representing the people and the government steadily and persistently refuse to receive the very class of men which have a deeper interest in the defeat and humiliation of the rebels than all others. Men in earnest don't fight with one hand when they might fight with two, and a man drowning would not refuse to be saved even by a colored hand." Now, there's so much here that I really don't have time to read. And it's mainly about the obstacles, racist obstacles that were thrown in the way of black soldiers enlisting to fight for the Union. But what I do want to read to you is some of the results that happened after black soldiers were enrolled. The chance to lead their own hands, to lend their own hands to the process of freedom, more than made up in most cases for the inequities and harassment then visited on African American volunteers. Quote, "It really makes one's heart pulsate with pride as he looks upon those stout and brawny men, fully equipped with Uncle Sam's accoutrements upon them," wrote James Henry Goodling, a black corporal in the 54th Massachusetts, quote, "to feel that these noble men are practically refuting the base assertions reiterated by copperheads and traitors that the black race are incapable of patriotism, valor, or ambition," end of quote. It also helped that the white officers of the United States Colored, I'm translating an acronym, USCT, regiments were, on the whole, better trained and better motivated than their counterparts among the white volunteers. Since the USCT were mustered directly into federal rather than state service, officers' commissions came through the War Department rather than through politicians in the state capitals, and the Bureau of Colored Troops quickly instituted a rigorous application and examination process to screen whites who wanted to become USCT officers. As a result, most of the officers' commissions in the USCT went to experienced former sergeants and officers from white volunteer regiments, many of whom were ardent abolitionists who saw the USCT, as the troops themselves saw it, as a lever for freedom and equality. Some of the officers, whatever their level of sympathy for these goals, entered the USCT with their perceptions of blacks clouded by the hard growths of racial prejudice and doubts about the capacity of African Americans to stand up to the shock of combat. But once the black troops had their first opportunities in combat, the prejudices and doubts rapidly disappeared. In May 1863, the black Louisiana militia led 6 furious assaults on Confederate fortifications in Port Hudson, Louisiana, where they were followed the next month by the hand-to-hand defense of Milliken's Bend, Louisiana, by 4 black and 1 white Union regiments. Even the commander of the Confederates, Henry E. McCulloch, was forced to concede that, quote, "This charge was resisted by the Negro portion of the enemy's force with considerable obstinacy, while the white or true Yankee portion ran like whipped curs almost as soon as the charge was ordered," end of quote. But the bloodiest laurels for black soldiers were won by the cream of the black volunteers, the 54th Massachusetts, with a blue-stocking white colonel, Robert Gould Shaw, and 2 sons of Frederick Douglass in its ranks. On July 18, 1863, Shaw and the 54th Massachusetts spearheaded an infantry attack on Battery Wagoner, one of the outlying fortifications covering the land approaches to the harbor of Charleston, South Carolina. A full day's worth of bombardment by federal gunboats offshore had failed to silence the Confederate artillery in the fort, And when the 54th raced forward to the fort's walls, their ranks were shredded by Confederate fire. Nevertheless, the 54th swept up over the walls and into the fort, with Shaw and one of his black color sergeants dying side by side on the parapet. The 54th gamely hung on to one corner of Battery Wagoner, but they were finally pushed off after a stubborn resistance. Sergeant William H. Kearney staggered back from the fort with wounds in his chest and right arm, but with the regiment's stars and stripes securely in his grasp. Quote, "The old flag never touched the ground, boys," Kearney gasped as he collapsed at the first field hospital he could find. The extraordinary valor of the black troops at Port Hudson, Milliken's Bend, and Battery Wagoner sent waves of amazement over the North. Abraham Lincoln, who had been as dubious about the fighting qualities of the black soldiers as other whites, now agreed that, quote, "the use of colored troops constitute the heaviest blow yet dealt to the rebellion." Well, there's more, but I'll stop there. So any illusions we had about the North being non-racist must evaporate. And the fact of racism permeating the whole society becomes quite evident. That in no way takes away from the guilt and the wrong of slavery in the South. And the one bright star in all of this are the evangelicals of the North, principally of the North, who really did want to abolish the institution of slavery. Okay, we'll stop there.